From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. In case you missed it, that's the theme of today's show. Food stories produced at KCRW that have never aired on this show, Good Food. This first one comes from The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. Last year, he interviewed Quentin Tarantino when his movie Django Unchained was released. The following is an excerpt of their conversation.
One of the things before we get into Django, I wrote a piece recently for a magazine that plays very much in what all the movies have been, but Django in particular, about how food is used for power in your movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's actually funny. It was, I think when Edgar Wright read the script for Inglourious Basterds, he goes, well, one of the things that I loved is the way you have the Nazis just luxuriating in these French restaurants, like they're just gluttons with their pâté and their crème brûlée. And, yeah, no, it's funny, though, because I don't actually think I would have written in the case of, like, say, this movie. One of the things is Calvin Candy.
The slave owner played by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, exactly. He's always indulging his sweet tooth throughout the whole movie, and he's got these
horrible teeth,
jacked up teeth. Yeah,
we call it British pop star.
Right, exactly. Now, I never would have written anything as obvious as, "Oh, guess what? Calvin Candy eats a lot of candy." Yet. Leo just kept ingesting sweet crap throughout the whole making of the movie for his character. And while I think that would have been an obvious idea, writing it down and actually trying to do it as a metaphor for the character, in practice, it was just delicious.
But it almost makes sense for the character because he almost is a lot of times having sugar reactions, like sugar highs and sugar crashes.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, he could definitely take the Twinkie defense.
But I love that for you, and I wonder where this comes from, this thing that food becomes this real metaphor for the way power is used in the movie, the way people exert power. The scene where Sam Jackson comes in Pulp Fiction and basically jacks the kahuna burger.
Right,
I mean,
exactly,
and sort of, and from then on, food really exists in these movies for you as a way that power is conveyed.
I think it just always associated, like, getting to know somebody, trading back and forth information, finding out if you're compatible, anything like that, always happens over restaurants and dinners. I've always found restaurant scenes to be kind of ritualistic. And usually inside of those rituals becomes, I've never thought about it exactly the way you're saying as far as this power thing, but it happens because I have rituals play out. And some of them are the rituals of the balance of power shifting. Being established.
They're always about either that establishment of power, somebody basically and establishing a power over food.
Yeah, yeah.
And a sort of consequence of that, or constant of that rather, is that people eat in your movies. Mm-hmm. Often when people sit down in restaurants in many other movies, they don't eat.
It really, really bugs me when I watch actors avoid eating in scenes because they don't want to have to, you know, do 9 takes. Where they're, you know, eating the donut. I eat 9 different donuts. You know, you even hear them talking about it on the commentaries. You know, oh boy, so-and-so, I didn't eat any donuts, so I didn't have to, you know. But Eric Stoltz, he took a bite of that one, and he had to eat 8 donuts. Poor guy. And it's like, that's just BS. You have to indulge. You have to eat. And if you're supposed to enjoy it, it should make me hungry. I actually do kind of like, and then this is not apropos to anything that we're, per se, but I do like the fact that when you see my movies, you know, there might be one drink or one piece of food that the audience fixates on, and the movie actually makes them hungry for that. They want that once they get out of the theater. When you watch Jackie Brown, you want a screwdriver. You want to have some orange juice and vodka, like Gordell. You're ready for it. I defy anyone to not want strudel when you see Inglourious Basterds. It doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't matter that just this Nazi guy's eating it. It's like, it's just, man, that strudel looks good. Same thing for the nachos in Death Proof. You just want them. But, you know, it's interesting what you're saying about the power because it's like in every way, shape, and form, Jules coming in there as this black male just completely dominating this room of younger white males by taking a bite out of the guy's hamburger. What's like the one thing you never do? You don't offer your hamburger for a stranger to take a big bite right out the middle of it. You don't do that. You could offer fries. There's all kinds of pizza. There's all kinds of things you could offer up to a stranger. But to take a bite right out of the middle of your burger is just not done. He took it. He took it from him.
Looks like me and Vincent caught you boys at breakfast. Sorry about that. What'd you have?
Hamburgers.
Hamburgers! The cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast. What kind of hamburgers?
Cheeseburgers.
No. Where'd you get them? McDonald's, Wendy's, Jack in the Box, where?
Big Kahuna Burger.
Big Kahuna Burger? That's that Hawaiian burger joint. I hear they got some tasty burgers. I ain't never had one myself. How are they?
They're good.
You mind if I try one of yours? This is yours here, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is a tasty burger.
We go through all the movies. I mean, even the fight in Kill Bill Part 2, Beecher wanting the rice. I mean, that's literally the way power is used to sort of get food across.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And it's very much a part of Django Unchained as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
one of the drawbacks of doing a movie about slavery in the antebellum South is I just can't put my characters in a restaurant and have them discuss the plot. I literally remember because I hate to have like expositional sequences, and so I always try to overload them with other stuff so you don't quite realize you're having the story told to you.
Because you do that at the beginning of Inglourious Basterds over the milk,
right. Yeah,
which
exactly.
Is another power there.
And yeah, that's a big one as far as power is concerned. But you know, it's like, oh man, things would be so easy if Schultz and Jenko could just go into a restaurant in Nashville and discuss their plans. But that's just not in the cards.
That was filmmaker Quentin Tarantino in conversation with Elvis Mitchell, host of KCRW's The Treatment.
His name was Cain. He had a horse along the countryside. I saw him ride.
Anything That Moves. It's the title of Dana Goodyear's book about the fearless cooks and eaters who are redefining the norm in American food culture. Dana's also a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we always love when she turns her attention to the edible world. KCRW's Steve Chiatakis spoke to her when the book was published late last year.
The first sentence of this book is, "Bugs, horse, brains, whale, leaves, weeds, ice cream flavored with lichen-covered logs." Why do people eat those kinds of things?
Americans' sense of what is edible is undergoing a thorough revision right now. And there are some thought leaders in this area, chefs and diners alike, as well as purveyors, who are starting to make an argument that the way that Americans have been eating for about 100 years is way too narrow. It's not good for you on a personal health level, and it's not good for the planet, and it's just not interesting.
A lot of meat and carbs, right?
And a lot of factory farm meat and
processed foods,
skeletal muscle, and then processed foods that using a very narrow array of plants, basically. So what's happening is that people are starting to say there's more out there. Let's look at some cultures that have historically been more resourceful with their eating because they've had fewer options. And let's see what else is available. This is leading people to eat things that have never been eaten in America or have not been eaten in America for a very long time. It makes some people uncomfortable because we're confronting some dietary taboos that can be pretty squirm-inducing. In the past several years, chefs have started to exalt these traditional foods of poverty and say, hey, guys, this is not disgusting, first of all. It's delicious, and you should pay $200 for a meal that includes it.
Yeah, but
there's a little bit of an irony there, of course.
If the poor people were eating it because it was readily available and cheap way back when, why are we spending $200 to eat it today?
It's a philosophical decision. On the one hand, it's saying that if we're going to be raising animals for consumption, we need to be being more resourceful and conservative with how we use them. We have to be using every part. We can't be throwing so much away or calling so much waste or diverting so much to pet food. it's also an aesthetic argument, which is this is more interesting. There are more complex flavors. It's fun to eat this way. It's fun to be challenged as a diner.
I mean, but would eating a grasshopper be fun, really?
It is fun. I've done
it. Really?
It's so fun.
What's a grasshopper taste like?
A grasshopper tastes like the oil it was fried in and the lime that you squeezed on it.
So, all right. Yeah, so then why not just have something else, you know? A tofu or something like that. I mean, why grasshopper?
Well, animal protein it's something that we as humans instinctively, most of us, want to eat. And
we need those things, right?
There are a lot of there are micronutrients in animal proteins that we need. Insects are enjoyed by 80% of the world as a delicacy, as a treat, or even just as the traditional meal that they are used to. And some Americans are starting to think that this might be an interesting way for us to eat, too. It might be a solution to some of our food-related problems, and it might also be exciting and something to boast about on social media to your friends.
I know a lot of the places that you focus on in your book are right here in L.A., where you live. And one of the people that you profile is Jonathan Gold, who is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic for was with the L.A. Weekly, now with the L.A. Times, and who also appears every week here on KCRW's Good Food. You find that he pioneered a lot of this new way of thinking about food.
He started to make this argument 25 years ago that lower on the food chain and in places you wouldn't expect to get great meals, you're getting great meals. And he made a lot of these restaurants and a lot of these neighborhoods in LA accessible to people. And he was a champion of resourceful eating. And some of his ideas have started to influence people far outside of LA. The other thing that Jonathan has influenced, I think, is the perception of what he calls dining as sport. And he's not entirely comfortable necessarily with having encouraged so many of these macho eaters who eat for a challenge. But his writing style and his attitude have encouraged people to think of eating as a fun daredevil sort of sport. And then, of course, there are other people in this field, Anthony Bourdain, Andrew Zimmern. And
we're certainly seeing a lot more these days, right?
And now it's become a commonplace, this idea that a foodie is somebody who eats things that their friends are shocked by.
Right. Adventurous, right?
Adventurism is an inherent part of foodieism now, which is not the same as the profile of the gourmet in mid-century America was a very different sort of person. This was a well-heeled fat cat who was probably white, probably male, probably over 60, and had nothing to do with the Filipina social media addict who is going out into the San Gabriel Valley and eating ox penis soup with her friends.
And to be sure, you're one of these adventurous as well, right? In the culinary world, Dana Goodyear. I mean, was there anything that you were nervous to try and ended up actually enjoying?
Lots of things.
Tell me.
Because I'm really not I can't hold my own with these people, but I had to eat a lot of things just to be allowed to stay in the room. You know, I did when I would reject food, I would have people turn to me and say, "Are you a government agent?" and things like that.
Are you serious?
I constantly was having to prove my legitimacy and the fact that I was not undercover. I found the most challenging thing for me to eat was a century egg. I actually could not get the century egg into my mouth. However, I found that ant pupae, otherwise known as Mexican caviar or escamoles, are really wonderful. Probably the most unfamiliar thing that I tried was a cup of coffee. Now, I drink a lot of coffee. And
touché. So do I. Absolutely.
There's a kind of coffee called Kopi Luwak, which is very, very expensive. It's about $1,000 a pound, depending on the harvest.
Yeah.
It has been collected from the droppings of a Sumatran or Thai civet, so basically a wild cat, and brewed. It's one of the most expensive ingredients you can get anywhere. I had it in a coffee shop in Santa Monica, actually. You can get it in Las Vegas. You can get it from Dean and DeLuca. And the flavor is, now I may be suggestible to tasting notes offered to me by the person preparing the food,
of course,
but we all are, right?
Yeah,
but it's sort of caramelly. It's sort of apple pie flavored. It's really lovely. You're not allowed to.
Did you know this going in, though?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I knew exactly what it was before you drank it.
I knew what it was. But then the other point that I want to make about exotic food or strange food or unfamiliar food is that it's so bound up in our immediate context. So I explore the origins of the gourmet industry in my book. In the 1940s, when this was a brand newborn industry in our country,
yeah.
Hawaiian punch was considered an exotic delicacy, and marinated artichokes, and baby corn, and in the 1970s, they sold tinned Bengal tiger meat at the Safeway in Washington, D.C. So context and temporal context are really important. And we have a very short memory for the things that we recently thought were disgusting and now think are delicious. Sushi, for example.
And now, yeah, you can't throw a rock and not hit a sushi place.
You can get it at any grocery store in America, practically.
Yeah. It's certainly an interesting book, and I want to thank you, Dana Goodyear. It's opened my mind, broadened my horizons. I don't know how much. I don't know about cat dropping coffee, but but it's certainly something that I will explore
going down the road.
It's
too expensive a taste to cultivate, trust me.
$1,000 a pound. You are absolutely right. Dana Goodyear with the new book. Thank you so much for joining us. Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You're listening to a Good Food Special. In case you missed it, food stories from other KCRW programs. You just heard Steve Chiatakis, host of All Things Considered, in conversation with writer Dana Goodyear. Coming up, the food service industry creates a lot of work for college kids during the summer. But working in an Alaskan cannery, it's not the summer job that first comes to mind. We'll hear how one 18-year-old LA girl survived for a summer in a Quonset hut in Alaska.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to In Case You Missed It, a special episode of Good Food featuring food stories from KCRW shows that you may not have heard. This next story was produced for Unfictional, KCRW's storytelling program. Margie Rocklin, whose voice you'll hear in just a moment, is an award-winning writer living here in L.A. I've shared several meals with her over the years, and only after hearing this story did I learn that Margie doesn't eat fish. After listening to the story, I think you'll know why.
There are two kinds of people. There are leaders and followers, and I was a follower, and my leader was my cousin Janie.
If you're going to do crazy things, I think that when you're 18 years old, it's the best time.
That's my cousin Janie. She had gone to Alaska to work at a cannery. What happened was she talked me into coming back with her.
The guy I went up with turned out to be insane. I thought, we will have a much better time than I was having trying to live in this place with this guy who was really crazy.
What I remember hearing was that we were going to live rent-free in a 3-bedroom house and make a ton of money. But what she didn't tell me was that the house was a World War II Quonset hut, and it was located 3 miles off the main road and 15 miles from town, and we didn't have a car. Sometimes we'd run because there were Kodiak bear sightings, and we lived really close to a garbage dump.
The thing about the Kodiak bears is that they always say, you know, if you come upon a bear, run downhill, but our road was flat.
I know that I've teased you a lot over the years about how you enticed me up there. Have you ever had any thoughts about it?
No. Some people fix their Quonset huts up so adorably. I don't remember our Quonset hut being all that adorable.
I remember that one of the things that decorated the wall was kind of like a hollowed-out crab. Like someone had just hung a crab shell on the wall.
It didn't have a refrigerator.
There was no running water or electricity. We had like an outhouse. The only thing that I remember about the town was that, like I said, it was very small. There were 10 men to every woman, which meant that on my first day, I walked through town, everyone was like, "Hi, Margie," because they already knew I was coming, and which was, you know, a little unnerving at first. I remember there was a laundromat, there was a small grocery store, and then the rest was just strip clubs. And you just go to whatever cannery that you heard was hiring, and they would give you a horrible job. And I remember the first day of work, they gave us each these fireman gauge gloves. because we were going to size crab claws. Three different kinds of crab, Dungeness, Tanner, and King. And you would grab the claws and you would throw them into small, medium, and large. So it was a job that anyone could do. And it turned out that I was really, really good at it. I was just really, really fast. I was like much faster than everybody else. You know, I was just fast motion. I didn't understand that everyone was just working slowly. Like, I was just hot-dogging it. At the end of the week, I was making the same paycheck they got.
I did the whacking, I called it. Whacking the king crab legs and getting the crab meat out.
The forewoman, and I remember her name was Sedge. Sedge promoted me to a much worse job, crab degilling. It was like a giant rolling pin covered with sandpaper. And a man in front of me would saw a crab in half on a skill saw. And then he would throw the two halves to me. And then it was my job to rip off the shell and then knock the crab on my leg. And then the guts would fly out. And then I would sand the gills off and then throw it over my shoulder. And I did that all day long. I'd never had a job that required manual labor. Like, I'd only been done babysitting and stuff like that. The third and final job that I had was working on a vibrating scaffold. It was about 10 feet high. They would dump the shrimp straight from the boat down a chute onto a conveyor belt. What the vibrating would do was separate whatever kind of debris had come in with a load of shrimp from the shrimp itself. The thing was that when they turned off the scaffold, it would stop vibrating, but your legs wouldn't. And one time I was climbing down the ladder and I just fell off. I just crashed 10 feet to the floor.
You had to work until all of the shrimp was done. So we would put in these crazy, crazy long shifts.
And it never got dark.
Some people worked like 36 hours at a time.
All of the really hard jobs at the cannery were held by women.
Mostly the other men were out on fishing boats for really long periods. And then when they came into town, they just got drunk all day.
So it was a real Rosie the Riveter situation.
And they were just really strong women. And we weren't. What they gave us to keep us awake at our breaks were donuts and Swiss Miss. And you can gain a lot of weight really fast. And I weighed more when I worked up there than either time I was pregnant. I gained so much weight.
Okay, so you'd hitchhike into town. You'd work these really long shifts that may be the day shift or maybe the night shift, but they all look the same. And then you would have to hitchhike back home.
And then get back to the closet without getting eaten by a Kodiak bear.
And there was no running water or electricity, so we could only shower once a week, which we would do at the laundromat, and it cost $5 for 2 minutes. People would pick us up and they'd say, "Were you shrimping today?" And we'd be like, "Yeah, do you work there too?" "No! You smell terrible." I don't remember bringing home any money. I just remember that I only was going to work there until I got enough money to fly home. And it just seemed to take forever. Here's what I remember about finally getting to go home. We got a flight to Seattle. And then we hit the open road. Because you have to remember that this is a time when hitchhiking, it didn't conjure up dismembered bodies. You know, it was a thing that people did.
Then we were going to hitchhike to Marin County, where my sister lived, and someone would pick us up, and we smelled so gross that they would drop us off like 10 miles later. Then we got to Olympia,
and a truck driver picked us up, and he said to us, "I have 426 hours of recorded country western music." And then that's what we listened to for like 2 days or something.
The trucker took us to San Anselmo.
And we ended up at my cousin's house, Ruthie. And when we rang the doorbell, she opened the door and she wouldn't let us come in because we smelled so bad. We couldn't get the smell out of our clothes. I think we had to strip down to our underwear in her carport. She ended up burying our clothes in the backyard. This is my cousin Ruthie, and she remembers a lot more.
I remember a few things of the time. Number one, my marriage was falling apart. My former stepson was with us for the summer. My husband was having an affair. We had a house full of people at a very difficult time. The two of you showed up from Alaska so stinky and so hairy that you shaved and clogged all of our pipes. That's kind of what I remember.
Okay, I want you to tell the story one more time, but can you leave out the hair and just talk about the smell?
I don't remember the smell as much as I remember the hair.
I think she should leave out the part about getting divorced, yeah. Not that.
All I remember is the hair.
It was the hardest job I've ever had, and it will probably be the hardest job I will ever have. So I have had many, many experiences where a lot is required of me, but nothing was as grueling as that summer on Kodiak Island.
A lot of our experiences actually there were kind of traumatic, I think.
There was a grimness about it. But you know what? My feeling is this. It was an incredible experience about understanding what hard work is and that people do it every day, and you have to respect them for how hard it is to make a dollar, you know? You know, a lot of people learn that a lot earlier than I did, but I was from the San Fernando Valley, you know? I was looking for a place to plug in my blow dryer. You know?
Margie Rocklin is a regular contributor to Unfictional, KCRW's storytelling program. That story was produced by Margie, along with Unfictional's host, Bob Carlson. You Should Know. That was the theme of KCRW's second annual radio race. The radio race is literally a 24-hour radio sprint where producers across the globe have one day to create a short radio story based on a given theme. You Should Know was the theme this year. Idaho producer Jessica Murray thought we should know about fry sauce.
Living in Idaho, people know one thing about my state, potatoes. But there's something else you should know. Idaho has a saucy secret, one that most of the nation has never tasted, and one that most Idahoans consider potato perfect.
It was rich, creamy, tasty, great compliment for fries.
It's simply called fry sauce, two parts mayonnaise, one part ketchup, but it's so much more.
I have a very special relationship with fry sauce. I won't eat fries without fry sauce. Fries are nothing but a vehicle for fry sauce.
In Idaho, fry sauce is as common as ketchup in almost every drive-in and diner. But beyond our border, not so much.
Fry sauce does not exist in the South, by the way. They have no idea what it is.
But you had never heard of fry sauce until you got here?
No.
What? What do they do with them?
If it's true that they don't have fry sauce other places, I can never leave Idaho.
So here's your history lesson on this curious condiment. It was invented by the fast food chain Arctic Circle in neighboring Utah in 1948. Idahoans wholeheartedly adopted it as their own and can't imagine life without it.
You don't have French fries without fry sauce. That's the way it is.
And you don't have fries without potatoes. 45 minutes outside of Boise is Parma, population 2020. The second building on the left is Giant Produce, Inc., a packing warehouse where spuds are trucked, washed, sorted, and bagged for chain grocery stores and restaurants nationwide.
5.6 million pounds will be ran through this facility in approximately a month's time. And we're small potatoes. I mean, we're, in the world of potatoes, we're very small.
Throughout our tour, Chris Gibson asked me three more times, people really don't know about fry sauce?
Me and my fry sauce, I love it.
Now to the mecca of fry sauce, the Boise Fry Company. It's a restaurant where you order fries first and your burger on the side. Self-proclaimed Captain Jordan Crema has been with the Fry Company for 3 years, but he sticks to the basics.
I'm kind of a purist with fry sauce. If you guys really want to know, I can tell you the secret for any fry sauce. It's just love. It's that simple.
Just how much do Idahoans love their fry sauce? He says his store goes through 5 gallons of fry sauce a week. And for some, Fry sauce isn't just for fries.
There's people that'll put it on their salads. There's people that'll dip apples into it or use it as chip dip.
Fry sauce is good for anything. Burritos.
Burgers, hot dogs, nachos. Pizza, potentially, but only for your crust.
So if you ever get to Idaho, open your minds and open your mouths. Reporting from the potato capital of the universe, I'm Jessica Murray.
That story was produced for KCRW's second annual radio race. Coming up, does the noise level in restaurants drive you crazy? DNA's Francis Anderton uncovers why restaurants are so noisy and where you can go if you actually want to hear your dining companion. We'll continue with our show, in case you missed it, next.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
I'm Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food, and you're listening to In Case You Missed It, a special collection of food stories from KCRW programs. Restaurant noise continues to be a thorn in the side of diners. This next segment first aired in 2008 on KCRW's Design and Architecture show. What's so striking listening to it again now is how little has changed. 6 years later, I'd say noise is still the number one complaint I hear from my friends who go out to eat. By the way, the general manager at Mozza, who you'll hear Francis interview in a minute, is no longer there. But the noise level remains. I'd love to hear what you think is the best and worst restaurant for sound in the year 2014. But first, here's Francis.
How many of us have experienced this?
Francis?
What?
Francis?
Yes?
There's something I need to tell you.
What did you say?
There's something I need to tell you, Francis.
Jonathan, I'm sorry, I just can't hear you.
It's loud.
What are you trying to tell me? Tell me again.
Oh, my voice is hoarse. That was the restaurant critic Jonathan Goldeneye shouting to make ourselves heard in a trendy LA restaurant. Have you noticed that as the food in LA restaurants gets ever better, the interiors snazzier, so it seems to be getting harder to hear oneself speak? First off, here's Jonathan Gold talking about the role of sound in the eating experience.
People talk a lot about the idea of, you know, a restaurant as theater. And the sound certainly comes into that. The taste of the food comes into that. The smell comes into that. But sometimes I think that if you've blindfolded me and you walked me into, you know, say, Providence, or you walked me into Golden Deli, that I could probably tell what the restaurants were just by the sound. And it's as much a part of the total ambience as what's on your plate sometimes.
Gold says the sound in LA restaurants in recent years has changed.
Things have changed a lot since the old days when there were two kinds of restaurants. One was very loud and the other was so soft that you could hear a pen drop out of your pocket, that either had heart music or you could hear the cardiac infarctions from the other customers.
But you say things have changed from that to what now?
It seems like restaurants are getting louder and louder and louder. And with very few exceptions, we're dealing with, instead of loud restaurants and less loud restaurants, we're dealing with variations of extremely loud.
What do you think accounts for that?
It's different people coming to restaurants now. And, the old rock and roll saying, if it's too loud, you're too old.
I went to see Jerry Christoph, president of Venaclaus & Associates in Santa Monica. He's an acoustic designer, and I asked him about the role design plays in creating the sound environment in restaurants.
Well, we classify restaurants, I would say, in two categories, and they tend to be either one or the other. At the loud end, we would call it a high-energy restaurant. This is a restaurant that has, generally speaking, all hard surfaces. They reflect sound, and in a restaurant like that, the design is purposeful. Sound-reflecting surfaces like gypsum board, wood, metal, and so forth, glass. Whereas in a restaurant that's designed to be quiet, in a way it's more of a challenge for the designer because they want surfaces to look like they're hard, but we have to do our best to help them to find surfaces that absorb sound but yet are attractive from the aesthetic standpoint.
So what kind of surfaces might those be?
They could be an acoustical tile, it could be glass fiber, it could be polyurethane foam. There's a variety of materials like that. Some are more sophisticated than others. But generally speaking, to absorb sound, you need surfaces that are porous and that usually are an inch thick. But on the other hand, they don't have to be ugly. A fabric is always an attractive approach. There's just a whole variety of ways to do this. But the most important surfaces to make sound absorbing for a quiet restaurant are the overhead surfaces. In the ceiling plane, or let's say in that general area, the sidewall surfaces that are further from the talkers and listeners, they're not as important, but it's the ceiling that's important.
Well, here I am in Osteria Mozza on Highland and Melrose. It's the fine dining sister to Pizzeria Mozza, both owned by Mario Batali, Nancy Silverton, and Joe Bastianic. The food is beyond delicious, and it's usually packed. It was also identified as one of the loudest restaurants in LA. After hearing from Joey Kristoff, I understand why. In addition to the crowds of people, it has 23 feet high ceilings and hard surfaces, wood floors, walls of painted gypsum board, large glass windows and marble countertops in the cocktail bar. And the music is pounding. David Rossoff is the general manager, and he took a few moments out to talk to me about the Osteria sound.
Well, it's an old building with old bones, and the sound tends to rattle off of those bones in multiple directions. And it's not something we've avoided, but I don't know that it's something that we engineered or manufactured to end up this way. That said, we really do like the environmental addition of the buzz.
And then there's music, and I understand the music is kind of part of the concept here.
Yes. Throughout the company, a common thread that runs through all of the restaurants that Mario owns is the music. And we think there's nothing better than enjoying this kind of food while you're listening to The Clash's London Calling or something along those lines. That juxtaposition is a beautiful one for us. Not for everybody, but it is to us.
And to sum up, I guess, what would you say is the role of the sound environment in the restaurant experience?
You know, we don't think of it as noise, we think of it as environment. We want the restaurant to feel alive and to be fun and for people not to take what we do all that seriously, even though we take it very, very seriously. The environment has to be one of love and joy and appreciation for the food and the wine.
Next, I went to Providence. That's a restaurant also on Melrose, also serving food to die for, that's co-owned by Donato Poto with Michael Cimarusti and Chrissy Echeverri. It was picked by Jonathan Gold as one of the most comfortably quiet restaurants, as in, you can hear yourself, but it's not so quiet that the rest of the room hears you. Providence is in the building that once housed Patina, and when the new owners moved in, they made a few changes to improve the acoustics. Here's Donato Poto.
There was a lot of wood here before. A little bit, the restaurant was surrounded by wood. So we wanted to soften things up. We covered the walls with a padding, and on the top we put in some fabric, Italian fabric. It's got rough edges, it's not smooth, so somehow they told us that this fabric would work much, much better for the sound, and indeed it did.
They also applied art to the walls, hand-blown porcelain shells that deflect sound. They hung resin lights in wave-like shapes that act as baffles, and they put down carpet and tablecloths. But the goal was not to stifle sound altogether.
A pleasant thing in a restaurant is to actually hear a combination of plates and glassware and silverware. Somebody deboning a fish, and a boyfriend and a girlfriend that are actually chatting with each other. Those are all pleasant noises. When you put together all those pleasant things, that's what music is all about. That's why you enjoy restaurants. All those little details, they add up, and at the very end, they make a complete experience.
That was Donato Poto of Providence talking about the design of the sound environment at his restaurant.
And that was Frances Anderton, host of DNA, KCRW's design and architecture show. That segment first aired in 2008, but it sounds pretty contemporary, right? Hard surfaces are still rampant in restaurant design. When I recently spoke to Bon Appetit's restaurant editor, Andrew Knowlton, he wondered if restaurants were actually getting louder, or if we're just getting older.
I don't know if I'm getting older or they're just not spending the money on soundproofing. You know, that's expensive to soundproof a restaurant. And if they're packing as many tables as they can in a room and, you know, the restaurant's full, I don't know really how you get around that. It is something that I've noticed. And, I know Michael Bauer, and the restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, even in his reviews, has little bomb symbols of how loud the restaurant is to warn people. And it is something I'm conscious of. I think we go out for different reasons. We listen to music, different types of music for different reasons. We listen to jazz when we kind of want to mellow out, or classical when we want to think. And I think restaurants are the same way. Sometimes you want to go out and be in a loud restaurant and be buzzy. And then sometimes you want to go to a more quiet restaurant where you can have a conversation with somebody you haven't seen in a while. So I think that that's on the consumer a lot of times to kind of decide what space they're going into and know what that restaurant is.
I think sometimes that this is an incredible opportunity for some really smart young designer, because as soon as we moved away from that continental look of carpeting on the floor and double draping on every single table and big heavy drapes at the windows, I mean, you took away all the sound dampening materials.
You did, yeah. And if you have concrete floor and backless wooden stools and, you know, a stainless steel kitchen in the restaurant exposed, that's a recipe for a loud restaurant.
Yeah, and who wants to eat on carpet anymore?
Yeah, I don't know. Carpet and food always gross me out a little bit.
So gross.
They clean. I have two kids, so when I look at the floor, there's a lot of food down there. I don't even care if you have kids. There's always a lot of food. And it's like, where does that food go on a carpet? I don't even want to know.
And now I'd love to hear from you. What are the best and worst restaurants for noise level in Los Angeles? Does noise actually keep you from going out to eat to specific places? Do you lose your voice after an evening out? Join the conversation on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Coming up, have you ever had a Kobe beef slider? If so, I'm sorry to say it, but you probably got duped. We'll look into the world of food fraud when Good Food continues.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Kobe beef. Just the words conjure a feeling of decadence. It's expensive and it's rare. And most people have no idea what they're paying for, so it's ripe for fraud. The fraudulent sale of Kobe beef isn't new, but recently a series of class action lawsuits is bringing the issue to the surface once again. Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson has the story.
If you've ever eaten a Kobe burger or a Kobe slider, it's time to ask for your money back. And customers at restaurants like Katsuya, Sushi Roku, Boa Steakhouse, and even Barney's Beanery are doing just that.
These businesses are passing off their meat as being Kobe beef when it is anything but Kobe beef. And they're charging premium prices to consumers who are paying those prices because they think that it is, in fact, Kobe beef, and it's not.
Kevin Shankman is the class counsel on all of these suits. The latest one is against SBE Restaurant Group, who never returned my calls requesting for comment. But to understand why customers are demanding a refund, you have to back up and understand exactly what Kobe beef is.
Kobe is the city in the Hyogo Prefecture. A certified Kobe beef has to be from a purebred Tajima cattle, which is born and raised in Hyogo, and then slaughtered in Kobe.
Chef Thomas Inger is the executive chef at the Park Hyatt's New York Grill in Tokyo. It's a well-respected steakhouse that serves a lot of Japanese beef.
Only after inspection of the meat and certain criteria are fulfilled of the marbling, then only it's going to be called Kobe.
The most common comparison to Kobe is champagne. There are strict rules about where the product is grown and how it's cultivated. And just as sparkling wine from California can't be called champagne, a Japanese cow raised in Colorado can't qualify as Kobe. Chef Inger told me that only 0.6% of all Japanese cattle are considered Kobe. And of that tiny fraction, an even smaller amount is exported to the U.S.
Less than 300 pounds per month were imported last year from Japan, which is, you know, a very small amount when you think about all the restaurants in the country. I mean, that's 10 pounds a day.
Larry Olmsted is a journalist who's been following Kobe beef fraud for a few years. In an article for Forbes magazine, he described it as food's biggest scam.
Even in Japan, the average person has never had Kobe beef. It's not like in Maine, you know, with lobster. It's not like people are just eating it all the time. It's still $200 a pound in Japan.
Just to put that $200 a pound in perspective, the most expensive beef you can buy at a Whole Foods in L.A. is the dry-aged ribeye for $25 a pound. The astronomical prices that Kobe demands are due to extreme quality control.
The beef doesn't just have to come from Kobe and from these particular cows. It still also has to grade out to the highest level. So some of these cows being raised on these Kobe beef farms still aren't sold as Kobe beef just because they don't have the right marbling.
According to Chef Inger, it's the unique breeding and relaxed lifestyle that makes the marbling so specific.
They live that for 32 months. So it's a long process of feeding them in a very relaxed state, and that's where the marbling comes from.
If you've ever heard rumors of Kobe cows being massaged and fed Sapporo beer, those stories are actually true. But that's not what creates the unique flavor.
The reason they started actually giving them beer is because, you know, Japan is very humid and hot during the summer months, and the beef didn't eat. So they started giving them beer to induce the appetite. And then they started, you know, playing music to have a ritual to get them, you know, eating or feeding to a certain time. And apparently it relaxed them as well.
All this coddling results in a beef that is unlike anything you've ever seen in the U.S. The fat in Kobe beef appears like lace. Instead of the streaked marbling you see in American steaks, Kobe looks as though it's been splatter painted, literally speckled with an even layer of white fat. While visiting a slaughterhouse in Kobe, Larry Olmsted saw firsthand how the meat differs from American beef.
One of the inspectors showed me cut a very small piece of fat off the exterior of this side of beef and put it on his hand where it melted, almost as if it was a chip of ice. So it literally melts in your mouth.
All this is to say that you're not going to get that melt-in-your-mouth quality beef in a slider at your local chain restaurant. Olmsted says that even a $50 Kobe burger wouldn't make economic sense, which is why Kevin Shankman is trying to stop prominent restaurant groups from abusing the word Kobe. He says that restaurants and menus need to be forthright with where their beef is coming from.
People, when they're presented with something saying Kobe style or American Wagyu, don't think that this is coming from Japan and is the real thing.
With the exception of a Marriott near Chicago, the restaurants that have come under fire from Kevin Shankman have all stopped describing their beef as Kobe. Plus, anyone who claims to have eaten the fake Kobe is eligible for a gift certificate. But to ensure that you don't get scammed, Larry Olmsted has this advice.
You know, while you can get Kobe beef now in the United States, it's still so cumbersome and so expensive and so sort of fraught with the risk of being ripped off that, you know, I'd save it for a trip to Japan.
For Good Food, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
And now to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where we know there are no fakes. Laura Avery's there with a look at what's fresh and in season this Labor Day weekend.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're heading into the final weekend of summer, and everybody's going to be hanging out in the yard and hopefully doing a lot of grilling. I'm talking with David Wolf, who's the executive chef at Feed, which is a wonderful restaurant on Abbot Kinney. And David, you have been in and around the market for years. You're here shopping today. What are you looking for, and what are you going to cook?
Well, Tenorelli from the Upper Desert, where actually I grew up, has some wonderful O. Henry peaches, and I'm planning on using those as a little accompaniment to a natural scallop dish that I do, where I make a fava bean puree to give it kind of an earthy background, and then a really bright, slightly spicy peach salsa that complements that. So it's a really nice combination. Very easy for someone to do at home also.
And the O. Henry is a classic old variety of peach. It's a yellow peach. Yes, it's full of, you know, the acid for sweet balance. Yes. Is that a freestone or a cling?
It's a freestone, yeah.
So it's
yeah.
easy to get off it's the off the pit. Off.
Yes, yeah. yes it is, yes, yes. And also, I do take those and I grill them also. We have a nice hanger steak on the menu. Where we make a grilled vegetable kind of spicy salsa to go over the hanger steak. And then I have a nice half of a peach, lightly grilled and drizzled with a little bit of fig balsamic, a really nice fig balsamic vinegar.
So when you're grilling a peach, you cut it off, hopefully you get a nice clean half.
Yeah, clean half.
What do you baste it?
I just brush it with a little bit of olive oil. Mm-hmm. And put it on a very hot grill, okay? So it just really gets those nice sear marks. Mm-hmm. Mark it both ways, maybe 2 minutes, okay? And then turn it over and just let it soften up a little bit on the other side. If it's ripe, you don't need to do it too much.
Right, and so, yeah. And
actually a slightly firmer peach for that would work well.
Right, okay. Well, we got plenty of peaches now, and not only the yellow, we still have some white ones, so this is a fantastic time to just throw a bunch of fruit on the grill and gobble
Absolutely.
It up.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, David.
You're welcome. Thank you, Laura, for having me.
That was David Wolf. He's the executive chef at Feed and giving us some great fall tips for how to cook these wonderful late peaches. We're talking with John Tenorelli, who is the farmer David just mentioned, the northern Los Angeles County farmer. John, you're up in Little Rock in the north. In the northernmost part of LA County, you've been growing peaches, you know, multi-generational. Tell us about your O. Henry's and the other peaches that you're growing.
Well, we grow a lot of peaches, and in the late season, we grow a little extra because the other growers are, you know, we're running down, and ours ripen about 2 weeks after theirs do. So our O. Henry's are one of our best peaches. They've been, gosh, for the last 20 years, the best, you know, Cadillac of the peaches. But we've got several new varieties come right after the O. Henry's. They're going to be good, too, you know, the next few weeks. Then we get into our late-season peaches, Fair Times and Last Chance, and they'll be running all through September. The peaches will be kind of rare everywhere else except for our area.
Is that because you're at a higher altitude and because of the variety you grow up there?
Mostly the altitude. We're about 3,000-foot elevation, so that's why everything blooms later and then comes and ripens later. And we still have a lot of sun out there in all through October. It's real sunny as opposed to San Joaquin Valley, where most of the peaches are grown. Gets a little foggy and cloudy and not so much sun.
So your peaches, you bring them in, though, beautifully layered, two-layer boxes, and those are all put in there by hand, huh?
Yeah, everything's done by hand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, picked and hand-packed and not much sorting. We kind of sort them when we get here at the market, but yeah.
Okay. So they spend no time then in a cooler? They're kind of taken right off the tree and brought to market?
A lot of times, but we don't, you know, 6-7 days in a cooler. We do have a cooler. You can't keep them in 100-degree weather, 90. But it's 6 or 7 days, you know, as opposed to 3-4 weeks in the wholesale markets. Mm-hmm. My peaches, you can take them home and keep them for 10 days, and they'll be just as good as, you know, when you got them.
So good, John. You think you'll have peaches all the way through October?
These good melting flesh peaches will be finished by the end of September this year. Then we have a late season peaches. We have a pause of about a week, and we have a late season variety called Autumn Lady that ripens normally November 1st, but this year will be October 15th. And that variety is really good. It's sweet, good flavor, but it's not really a melting flesh, but people like it. It's a really good tasting peach. But
it's the last peach in the state?
Yeah, yeah, it's mm-hmm. the last peach anywhere in the mm-hmm. United States.
Oh, fantastic. All right, John. Well, this is exciting, and they're so delicious right now. So thanks for growing this great fruit.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
That's John Tenorelli, and he's at least a second-generation farmer, owner of Tenorelli Ranch in Little Rock, with these wonderful late summer and early fall peaches. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for David Wolf's peach salsa with roasted jalapenos is on the Good Food blog. We've also got a few peach pie recipes there, so you can start practicing for the 6th annual Good Food Pie Contest. This year, the contest is Sunday, October 5th at the Fowler Museum at UCLA. We were inspired by the museum's collection of non-Western art to create a brand new pie category for this year's contest. We're calling it the World Pie Category. It's open to interpretation, of course, but this next interview will provide some motivation. Here's Marcus Samuelson talking about bobotti pie.
Bobotti is a wonderful lamb or mutton pie. It can be done with goat as well. And you find it in the Malay kitchen in South Africa. So aspect of Cape Town, Durban, the Malay is sort of the Indian and Indonesian tribes of South Africa. So with this, you take sort of ground lamb and a little bit of onion and cardamom and spices. It's not spicy, but you cook it so it's really nicely cooked and flavorful. And then you put a crust on top of it, and then you bake it in the oven. And then you serve it with achar, which is in Indonesian pickles, and a chutney. And it is so delicious. This is what South Africans eat on a Saturday. And what's fascinating in South Africa is that there's the Dutch, of course, the Afrikaans, and then there's the black, and then there's the all these different blends, right? Just like America. But everyone loves bobotti. It's everyone's comfort food.
That was Chef Marcus Samuelson. We've been talking about bobotti pie. We've got his recipe on the Good Food blog. In fact, we have a ton of pie recipes on the Good Food blog, all to inspire you and to help you practice for this year's 6th annual Good Food Pie Contest. Registration is now open. Go to kcrw.com/pie to enter. Again, that's kcrw.com/pie. And if you feel you want something a little more personal, I'm excited to announce that we have a few pie classes coming up at the New School of Cooking in Culver City. On Thursday, September 11th, we've got a master pie class taught by the New School's Director of Culinary Education, Carol Kottner-Thompson. And me, of course, will give you all the tips and tricks you need to win a blue ribbon at this year's contest, and you'll go home with a freshly baked pie. All of these proceeds from these classes benefit the Good Food Pie Contest, so you can support a good cause and sharpen your pie skills at the same time. Go to newschoolofcooking.com to register. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW smartphone apps. Thanks to everyone who made today's show possible: Jillian, Laryl, Caroline, Ronnie, Gary, and the other producers here at KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Enjoy this holiday weekend and join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.